Hello and welcome to Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. My name is Emily, and today I'll be interviewing Daniel Spector. New York University's Tisch School of the Arts houses multiple drama studios, each of which teach their own technique for acting. One of them, the Classical Studio, was developed more than 20 years ago to use Shakespeare as the basis for acting education. The studio is a training ground for both classical and contemporary work, and has produced alums who've used their Shakespeare training to work in classical productions, in musicals on Broadway, and more. We are joined today by the studio's director, Daniel Spector, who was once a student in the program himself. He is a member of the Lincoln Center Theater Directors Lab and an alumnus of the Broadway Theater Project. He has served as a consultant to PBS on matters Shakespearean, moderated artist talks at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, led workshops for numerous arts organizations, produced many readings of new plays, and has spoken at conferences around the world, including the British Shakespeare Association, Offensive Shakespeare, BritGrad, the Shakespeare Theatre Conference, and more. Today, he'll talk with us about how Shakespeare's verse can be used to train actors, what kind of classes are taught in a small Shakespeare conservatory ensemble, how Shakespeare acting education transferred online during the pandemic, and more. I was also lucky enough to be a part of this program and to be a student of Daniel's, so it's a special honor to have him on the podcast today. So without further ado, here is Daniel. Hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you so much, Emily. I'm so happy to be here.
I am so happy to have you. Obviously, Daniel was a professor of mine at NYU, so it's an absolute honor to have you on here because I learned so much from you, and I think that everybody else can too. So tell us a little bit about you run the Classical Studio at NYU, and some people might not know what exactly a studio is because NYU kind of has a different setup in terms of acting education. So can you explain the studio system at NYU?
Yeah, we are, I'm pretty sure we're the largest drama department in the world, hundreds of undergraduate drama students. But the reason why, you know, your acting class doesn't have 50 people in it is because NYU has longstanding relationships, the Tisch School of the Arts in particular, the drama department has longstanding relationships with a number of professional acting studios that have long existed in New York City to train professional actors, like the Atlantic Theater Company Acting School, the Strasberg Institute, Playwrights Horizons Theater School. These are programs that not only, for the most part, train actors in New York City who aren't attending NYU, but they also have carved out part of their program and faculty and time and space to train the NYU undergraduate drama students. So between those programs, and studio is basically synonymous with conservatory, between those conservatories and also a few of our own homegrown studio / conservatories in the department, like the Classical Studio, like the Experimental Theater Wing, we are able to train these hundreds of students, but keep class sizes to a far more manageable, I would say, on average 12 to 16 students. So a studio is basically a actor training program that is distinguished by the method and technique and philosophy and approach that those individual studios take. So when you audition for the program, part of that process, which we call the artistic review process, is a committee determining, based on your audition, based on your interview, which of these studios are you best suited for to do what we call your primary training, which is your first 2 years of training. The Classical Studio, which I guess we're here to mostly talk about, which is where I teach, is what's called an advanced studio, which means students can audition for it once they've finished those 2 years of primary training and are looking for something different.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about the audition process for classical. So you accept students from all of the different studios and then take them into classical?
Exactly. Students who have completed those 2 years of primary training they have a few options open to them, including staying in that primary studio. But another option, like I said, is to audition for our program. So students typically from all of the studios who think they might be interested in what we do, prepare a Shakespeare monologue in verse to bring to our audition. As important to me in that time and space is the interview part where I get to know this person with whom I may be committing a year of my life to. You know, it's not just a sort of abstract training mechanism that they're auditioning for. It's also like my life and the life of the faculty. And so part of that process is, who do we think we could spend a productive and healthy and collaborative year of our lives with? So that's what that process is about. And then there's callbacks and the whole thing. And I just finished that.
Oh, that's so exciting.
A few days ago, and I calculated, I think about 40 hours total between the preliminary auditions and the callbacks. God. And I do spend a lot of time with the students in the callback process.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and when people come in to audition for classical, they're coming from, as you said, a studio with a certain school of thought and then expecting to enter, you know, a different one. So how would you describe sort of the technique or school of thought that classical revolves around?
Yeah, it's a good question and one that we're often asked. And I'm always at pains to try to explain because the students have come from, for example, the Stella Adler Studio of Acting. They've come from method training. They've come from what they teach at Atlantic Theater Company Acting School, which is practical aesthetics. So they're used to this notion of there being a sort of usually associated with someone's name. You know, an Adler, a Strasberg, a Grotowski. They're used to some sort of book-worthy or manual-worthy method of training. And while I suppose if you really pressed me, I could say there's a method at play in the background, really we just teach a few habits we think good actors know and can do, a few principles. Yeah. And the reason why we use Shakespeare as our primary training material, even though we don't consider ourselves a sort of classical acting program per se, is because the habit, what I've learned to call the habits of mind that Shakespeare requires of actors, I think are very applicable to pretty much any text, certainly in the Western tradition. You know, these plays to really work require actors to mean what they say, which is its own sort of process with actors, especially since they're very often coming from traditions that value a notion of subtext. Sarcasm, irony, etc. There's certainly irony in Shakespeare, but less sarcasm than I think people think. So one of the habits of mind that Shakespeare asks of, if not demands of actors, is just meaning what you say at any given moment. And in a way, though it's not that sexy of a sort of technique to talk about, That really is the umbrella of what we spend the year with students doing. What would it be like if you meant that line, that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't representative of something else, but that's actually the thing you mean to say. And then Shakespeare asks you to, as you're meaning everything you say, to solve some sort of problem with it, rather than represent that problem or complain about that problem. These characters are always solving something. And the way they're always solving something is by attempting to change in a way or persuade or win over the person in front of you. So sort of those three things, if you had to press me to say, what's our technique? It's we work on getting actors to mean what they say, to solve problems with what they say, to change the person in front of them with what they say. And of course, what is drama, but if not watching people usually fail at all of those things. And that's interesting.
That is interesting. So you work on that exclusively with Shakespeare, right?
Well, for much of the year, exclusively with Shakespeare, but in the second semester, and we've done this more and more, we do apply it to contemporary texts.
Yeah.
And we've even introduced in the past couple of years voiceover training. Ooh. And so we are applying these principles to everything from audiobook narration to even, you know, promos and commercials.
Wow. Oh, that's so cool. I love that. Yeah. It's interesting that Shakespeare can be taken into that context. I feel like people wouldn't normally think of it that way at all. So it's cool that you're taking, you know, this studio that seems to be so, you know, rooted in classical tradition and bringing it into more modern context. So that's amazing. And then what kind of classes are at Classical?
So the students take a core group of six classes, although we have a number of ancillary faculty members and artists with whom we have longstanding relationships who come in and teach workshops and enhance the curriculum in some way. The students take two acting classes, one with me that is very, I guess you could say, text and analysis based. They take a class with another acting teacher, Darcy Picot, who teaches emotional preparation. But we both speak the same language, so she's never too far from reminding them to use the verse form, for example, as much as I do. They take a voice and speech class, which trains them to speak clearly and healthily. They take also two movement-oriented classes, one that is Suzuki-based, and one that is a bit more body improv based. So really 50% of our curriculum is in some way related to the body.
Why is that important for classical acting, do you
think? What we try to, you know, it's easy with Shakespeare and it's easy with my own self and my own work to just to get cerebral with this stuff and talk about the ideas of lines. But the reason why, you know, Donna Germain, who teaches voice and speech, is such an effective teacher is because she's so good at, you know, relating the sounds of words and the sort of feelings that words produce in the ear, in the mouth, that, you know, those don't just come from the mind. Those come from the body. The body doesn't lie. And so it's important that the students find as many connections to every part of their body while they speak these words and don't just end up becoming talking heads.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And then on the text aspect of it, I know at Classical, there's a lot of verse work in terms of working with the text. So why do you at Classical feel that using the verse is so important in studying Shakespeare in a theatrical context?
Yeah, it's I certainly appreciate the question, and it's a good question to ask. It's also a funny question to me. You know, the terse answer to it is because that's the way he wrote it.
Right.
70-something% of the material is written in verse. Of course, plays like Richard II is almost entirely in verse. And it's clear with just a little bit of studying of the text in that form that that was not an accident. That there are, that there's clearly a lot of thought and intentionality that went into forming ideas into verse lines. And so the reason we teach the verse is because, first and foremost, that's the way it was written. Now, it's very easy with Shakespeare to just get sort of dogmatic and ideological about something because who knows why, because it's an exercise of power or something, or intellectual show-offery. But what we've found with the verse form is a few things. One, just on a purely practical level, if an actor employs the verse, and what does that mean? It means two things. It means recognizing the pattern of the iambic mm-hmm. pentameter, and I can talk about what I mean by that. And also understanding each verse line as a sort of discrete, distinct unit of thought. If an actor really does that and thinks that way and employs that in their work, two magical things can happen. One, after some training, it will not necessarily be detectable. In other words, an audience won't be bopping their heads along with the de-dum, de-dum rhythm because it's robotically coming from the actor. That will have been nuanced enough that it's not so obvious. But another thing will happen, which is that the audience will understand what the actor is saying. And I have found that the only way, and I don't just mean understand, that so-and-so's happy right now, or this other character is in love, or this person hates that person, and sort of, a general sort of emotional state, but the audience can literally follow the argument that the character is saying from thought to thought and from verse line to verse line. And I have found the only way that can happen with Shakespeare is by using the verse. And understanding a few basic concepts, like what does the iambic rhythm mean? It just means that certain words are a little bit more stressed than other words. And why are they doing that? Because the point that the character is saying is inscribed in that stress. It's a very different thing to say, are you going to dinner with mom? And saying, are you going to dinner with mom? Mm-hmm. Obviously, those are two different questions. And the verse is there to sort of point you in the direction of what's the character getting at. Mm-hmm. So between that and then, noticing, for example, that the most important word of the line tends to come at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And thinking of the verse form, not as actually, at least as Shakespeare employs it, poetic form, but actually what he's doing with it is replicating human thought and getting an actor to really think those thoughts in real time rather than recite eloquently a rehearsed text. That's what all that form is there for. So really the point of the form is to with some mastery make the form in a way disappear and just provide the illusion of what I think is your primary responsibility as an actor, is to provide the illusion that you're thinking and coming up with this stuff for the first time.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think because often when reading it, I think that especially students can kind of be put off by the poetry of it and find it too esoteric, but it's great to hear that you're able to use that, and that's the function of acting, is lifting it off the page and making it into what it was meant to be, which is just people talking. So I love that.
Well, if I can offer just a simple thought experiment, just even in this conversation that we're having alone, which even though I've talked about this stuff a million times, I've never talked about it exactly the way I'm talking about it with you right now. We've never had this conversation before. If you were to use one of those, computer programs that were to transcribe this conversation, it would spit out in verse, not in prose, because we're not speaking in complete sentences. We're not pausing where the period is necessarily, or where the comma would be. We're not using coordinating conjunctions where they should be, and blah blah blah. We're thinking out loud. And so if you can imagine looking at the verse on the page, which of course can be anxiety inducing because it just looks like poetry and Shakespeare, and that causes people anxiety. But if you imagine that that's actually what thinking would look like on the page rather than a prose paragraph, maybe that will mitigate the anxiety a little bit.
I love that. yeah, I kind of want to try transcribing my thoughts now and see what it looks like. Yeah, so then taking all of that that you're learning at Classical, last year you had to move a lot of that, like everyone else did, online because of COVID. So tell us about how remote instruction works for, you know, this kind of work. Were you able to make new discoveries this year? Anything like that?
So many. And things that I'll, you know, probably need much of the rest of the summer, if not the coming year, to really grapple with and understand. But, you know, I just said a moment ago, the body doesn't lie. In a way, the mm-hmm. camera doesn't lie also.
Yep. Yeah.
So I think one thing we found is in working so often, well, for the entirety of the fall semester, because our department went totally remote in the fall. Mm-hmm. So for the entirety of the fall semester and for much of the spring semester, we were working on cameras like everyone else. And I think what we found was, and one of the things I think we'll take with us into future years and future, you know, training, is that working on camera really sort of helps to diagnose all of those little tricks that mm-hmm. actors employ to get through a bit of text without really doing the work to make it specific. You know, mm-hmm. faces, vocal inflections, things that sort of get added on to a bit of text that don't more organically sprout from your engagement with what the person's actually saying or meaning what you're saying. So we found that, camera is a great and sometimes quicker way to diagnose that. Whereas in a theater, it's just much easier to get away with, for example, using volume instead of specificity or intention to emphasize something that a character is saying. And you can wow an audience just with, you know, yelling alone and skip over all kinds of opportunities to be actually more specific when yelling doesn't necessarily cut it. So so that's one thing we found. And I mean, as you'll know, one of the things I say to actors most of the day, all day, all year, is just to take unnecessary pauses out.
Yep.
And I have found in editing our video project, I've had to tell myself that because it's so seductive when you're cutting footage together to, oh, but this is such an interesting moment of just looking at Isabella's face before she says that line. And then, you know, you go back after a day, after a break, and look at that footage again, and you're like, nope, that's actually not necessary. Keep, do what you tell the actors. Keep it moving. Keep it going. Earn that pause. Yeah. So it's another
thing. That makes sense. And then we'll get into talking about your video production of Measure for Measure, which I saw and is fantastic. But first, before we do that, in a typical year, what would a production at Classical look like?
It would look very bare, very bare bones. We set ourselves the challenge of basically putting the actors into a large black room. Actually, it's not very large. Only seats about 50 people. It's a small black room. we have the audience on all four sides. I guess you'd call it in the round, but they're really in a square formation.
Yeah, in the square.
And the actors enter the space and begin a play and end after about 2 hours, 2 hours and 15 minutes with a little intermission. No furniture for the most part, unless a chair or some sort of, you know, seating device or some kind of implement is called for in the script. And I would say the suggestion of a costume, again, something that's called for in the script. And also giving the actors a little bit of sort of creativity to decide what they think their character would wear, but just enough
Yeah.
And so they're sort of learning efficiency of storytelling in the process. And then, you know, in essence, the challenge we set ourselves with, because there's nothing really visually dazzling to look at, there's no, for the most part, major changes in lighting, is can we hold the audience's attention with just words, bodies, and this story? Can we hold their attention? Can we make them follow the arguments of the characters at any given moment? Can we make sure that when the students go greet their friends and family backstage afterwards, they don't just say, hey, that was really awesome, congratulations, but they, to me, the highest form of praise after we do these shows is when the audience wants to sort of gossip with the actors about the characters. I can't believe Angelo said this when she said that, he said this, and instead of that, he said this. And so that's the goal, is to get people really engaged with the story and the play. That's the challenge. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then this year, when you had to take that online, you know, as I say, I saw it and I feel like, you know, those elements were all still present, of course. But there was the added sort of filmic elements that you had into it of creating a measure-for-measure mini-series. So tell me how you came up with the concept of a mini-series.
Yeah. So just for some context, we ended up with a 5-episode mini-series of the play Measure-for-Measure that basically ended up breaking down by act from episode to episode.
That makes sense.
You know, we had the benefit of, because we didn't even start shooting until March, we had the benefit of many months of what you might call Zoom theater, both live and recorded, and sort of watching, thankfully, other people's work, who sort of blazed the trail over the past year. And figuring, you know, watching that stuff and thinking about what we thought worked and what didn't. One of the things that, for me at least, just like didn't quite work is a 2-hour play.
It can be a lot to ask.
On the computer. For many of these productions, because they were, there was a rights granting process from this or that playwright's estate, they had to do it live. And they had to stream it at certain times. And therefore, you know, someone had to show up at a certain time and commit 2 hours to sort of watching this thing. And to be frank, very often I would tune out after 3 minutes because sort of, you go, I get the idea. There's other things I can imagine doing with my life right now. So, you know, when we went into figuring out how to do this project, it was a lot of like, we knew we didn't want to do it live because just the sheer time it takes to get the tech sorted out for live performance and all the mishaps that will inevitably happen through that process. We wanted to give people something a bit more bite size to chew on at a given moment, so you could just commit to an episode. Or even commit to having half an episode and come back later and watch the rest. And then we just liked, you know, the creative aspect of coming up with, you know, a theme song and an opening credits sequence. And how do we leave a cliffhanger at the end of this episode? So in theory, people want to come back and watch the next episode. And how do we add music to it? And so it was also just a way to get creative in ways that we don't usually do in that black box theater, empty space scenario. And how do we use all this technology that we have access to in ways and sort of lean into that?
Yeah. And it really was like a film in some ways in that, you know, some of it was via video calls and people talking over Zoom, which you of course made into a cool storytelling device. But there was also elements where you were filming people either together or people were filming on their own, I would expect. And, you know, of course, with the proper CDC guidelines in terms of being in this space. So how did you make the decision to kind of blend some of those elements?
Well, You know, in the spirit of saying yes and to this sort of scenario and pandemic and situation, you know, we did the thought experiment of the world of Measure for Measure being largely mediated by cameras, and that they were themselves in a pandemic context. In the case of, you know, Measure, we sort of combined pandemic with the sexual licentiousness that pervades the play and made it a sort of STD pandemic that has so proliferated and varied, as we now say with COVID, that it's become, you know, airborne and anyone can get it.
Love creepy, it.
rather creepy concept, but, you know, it made sense of the use of masks and made sense of, you know, all these characters sort of communicating from their rooms and at home through cameras. And so, and then when it made sense, or when it seemed to open up a creative possibility, we would use, besides webcams, other cameras. So for example, when Lucio goes to sort of fetch Isabella at the convent and tell her her brother's in jail and she's got to go to Angelo to plead for his life, one way of doing that is to have Lucio sort of go and ring the intercom or the front door bell of the convent and maybe expect to be let in so he could have this conversation with Isabella. But of course they don't want him there. He's a man for one thing.
Yeah.
It's a pandemic for another thing. So they have that whole conversation over the intercom. And so we don't actually see Isabella until she goes to Angela. We just hear her over the intercom for that first scene.
I love that. And you had so many inventive ways of dealing with it. One of my favorites was if you know the story, Isabella goes to see her brother Claudio to let him know that he has to die because she's not willing to sleep with Angelo to save him. And there is, you know, I've done Measure for Measure with you, and there was a moment when I did it of physical altercation between them just a little bit. But what I loved in this production was Isabella was speaking to Claudio in prison through a sort of video call while he was in prison, and he gets too close to the camera and it triggers an alarm. Right. And that sort of had the same feeling of violence. So I love how you've adapted the sort of physical element and figured out how to apply it in this context. So kudos on that.
It opens up a lot of new creative problems to solve, and again, why not lean into it and have fun?
Yeah, absolutely. So before we sign off, I was just kind of wondering, on a personal note as well, what drew you to Shakespeare to start? Why did you want to work with this for your career?
Well, I think it all begins with someone you had a chance to know in a small way for a period of time back in the day, who was the founder of this program and my teacher when I was in the program, and my mentor for many years thereafter, Louis Sheeter. He, you know, like everyone else in the program, I had been through my 2 years of primary training. I had started in the musical theater program. and then, long story short, ended up at the Classical Studio. And I just remember, even after that first class in September of the year 2000, realizing that I was in a place that so valued sort of rigor and specificity, that had my back, and that introduced Shakespeare in a way that I had never encountered it before. You know, I'd encountered it as great poetry, which in a sense it is, but that's not always helpful for an actor. So encountering it as the way we teach it, the way I now teach it, as thought in action, really stuck with me, and Shakespeare is it's a relationship, you know, yeah. that you're in, and you grow up with it, and you know, this is the fourth time I've done Measure for Measure. I would say in a span of maybe 12 years, and I, like any relationship, I have a different relationship to it now than I did 12 years ago. Yeah. And it's just a gift to be able to continue to grow up with these plays, learn more about them, understand them better, hopefully be able to teach them better, and develop our relationship.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. And I love how full circle it is. So thank totally. You so much. Is there anything else you wanted to share with us before we sign off?
Oh God. If people have made it this far and they're interested in the project, you can go to Measure for Measure, the miniseries.com.
Yes, I recommend it.
And check it out. And
well, thank you so much for coming in, Daniel. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. If you're interested in learning more, check out our site at nosweatshakespeare.com and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We look forward to talking Shakespeare with you again soon.